good morning. We're here with the Oat Health Podcast, number one, our inaugural show, May 1, 2009. And I'm Matt. I'll be your host today, and I'm here with Joe. Good morning, Joe.
Hey, good morning.
So we have some interesting topics today. I want to just give you a brief preview before we get into it. We do have some news to share with you, specifically about a review of 189 studies, interestingly confirming some links between diet and heart health. So we'll go into that. Some research about the effects of, actually nine effects, potentially modifiable risk factors. And then our main topic, really how three theories of disease, believe it or not, could affect you even if you don't know it. Those are our topics for today. And let's jump into the podcast. All right, and we're back, and like I said, I'm Matt. I'm here with Joe, and before we get into it, because this is one of our first shows, I wanted to remind you of some of the goals that we have for our podcast. Basically, we have three goals for a podcast, and you can hold us accountable to this, right, Joe?
That's right.
So the first one is keep people up to date with relevant news, and specifically industry news that sort of relates to what we would call like the nutraceuticals industry, things that have to do with using natural means to make you healthier. But we also include some things just from the general medical health industry. So we want to try to create some balance, keep things in check, offer some ways to look deeper into that news. We also want to take a look at research, teach you a little about what to look for, and also help you understand some of the terms that you may hear in health research. And then lastly, cover topics that are important to you if you're seeking to improve your health through natural means. We don't really want to answer all the questions, and then we'll try to pique your interest to learn more, and that can hold us accountable as well as anywhere else that you're hearing news. Lastly, as part of just covering these topics, we want to help you build a framework or a foundation that'll help you make better decisions ultimately. So that's our goals for the podcast, and let's jump into the news today. So Joe, this past April 13th, you found something interesting in the Archives of Internal Medicine.
Yeah, and this really is interesting to me. I think this is kind of tops the list of things that when I look for news and when I'm looking for research, this one really is kind of summing up a lot of what I feel that I'm looking for when I'm trying to figure out, okay, how do we help people with their health? And this one is actually a review of different articles. So a review is looking back over different studies. Some of those studies were randomized control studies, which is kind of the gold standard of studies that are out there.
Right.
Some of these were cohort studies, which is kind of just a level below that as far as validity and weight that it can have. And so altogether, like you said, 189 studies, looking back over 50 years of research. And this is hot off the press. This is April 13th. This has just come out. And so this is, from my standpoint, being a health geek, this is big news for me. This is kind of one of those things I look at. And
you eat it up, yeah.
I get excited about
it. Yeah.
So, really what they're looking at is just what are dietary factors that affect heart disease and how do they affect it?
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of cut through all these different things that were studied in these 189 studies and say, okay, what sticks out consistently between them all?
Mm-hmm.
And so you find two different categories, obviously, one being protective, one being harmful to heart health. In the category of protective, you got vegetables, nuts, monounsaturated fats, and the Mediterranean diet. And so not really exciting stuff. Not what you might be like. It's not resveratrol or acai.
Yeah, I'm not running to the store right now, but
yeah. So I mean, it's stuff that you're probably already eating, but we're not consciously making an effort to get more of them. And I think, especially when I look at this list, the nuts stand out to me as just as far as you know, those might have been demonized at a time for
right.
heart health.
Right.
You know, they're high in fat and they have, you know, a higher calorie count. And you know, I think a lot of people back in the day would say, stay away from nuts for heart health.
Stepchild status for a while, right?
So, yeah, I mean, all around, it's just, I'm glad that this kind of came out in this study. Monounsaturated fat and the Mediterranean diet kind of have some tie together because Mediterranean diet is high in olive oil. And I think what you really find in the Mediterranean diet in its core and what you find in there is, you know, whole grains, beans, nuts, seeds, root vegetables.
Right.
Don't ever go a day without fruit. Olive oil, which generally is a low processed oil, if you find extra virgin, very low processed oil. So less heavily processed foods, what you find.
So those are four things you're saying that are in the protective category that this review of 50 years worth of research has pointed out
consistently,
common.
Yeah. Over and over again, you see it in these 189 reviews that those things are beneficial. And then on the harmful side, you got the Western dietary pattern. Some people call it the SAD, the standard American diet.
Oh, boy.
And so, yeah, you're looking at, in that case, processed foods, lots of meat and lots of high-fat.
I'm feeling guilty already.
Animal products. So, you know, that's consistently across the board.
Yeah.
As a pattern, is not good for heart health.
These are in the harmful to heart health category.
Yes.
Okay.
And so high glycemic index foods, really in this category, top of the list is sugar, obviously, right? So
yeah.
High glycemic, some people might not be familiar with that, but it's really talking about how quickly something turns into blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And so sugar, obviously, a very quick shot of turning that sugar that you eat right into blood sugar and kind of bringing your blood sugar back up. So if you're diabetic and your sugar goes too low, you eat a piece of candy with sugar. And mm-hmm.
Or orange juice even, you know, right. That type of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's talking about a lot of foods that really can spike your blood sugar levels. And I think as a dietary pattern, we've sunk into too much sugar in this country. We eat about 10 times as much sugar as we did 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we look in looking at the last 100 years, we've made some of these changes. The next one, trans fatty acids, didn't really exist they're a very small amount in nature, but we've been eating over the last 50 years now increasingly more and more of these, and now
right.
just starting to see some of the
it's accessible. Yeah,
and so you're starting to see a ban on some of that as well, which is good, but all around some of these things that we've started to do more in the last 100 years or 50 years even, really starting to be detrimental to our heart health and just health in general. So yeah, so I mean, this research article really gets to the heart of what we talk about here in trying to get people to do a healthier lifestyle in general, is eat more of the real food,
yeah.
Eat more real food, eat less not real food, or, you know, make sure we're eating in a balance. I think that's a lot of what happened here as well, you know, especially in the category of nuts. I think of beans as well. You know, we're just not getting a balance of some different real food items
mm-hmm.
that people may have told us that we shouldn't eat or maybe are less convenient to include in our foods, and we've stuck more to the animal meats, more to the processed foods, more to the animal fat increase in the diet. So, yeah, I think this I was excited to find it. I think it really speaks to what we try to talk about here at OHealth.com.
Okay, so I mean, it sounds like there's, you know, what's interesting, if I could just put my own take on it, and you can clarify, is that there's 189 studies over 50 years. It's a long period of time. They reviewed it, found two patterns, right?
Huge.
Protective category and a harmful category. And then you have the four things you mentioned, vegetables, nuts. We talked about monounsaturated fats on the good side, Mediterranean diet, more to the whole unprocessed, and then harmful Western dietary pattern is something we got to watch out for, which includes things like high glycemic index foods, trans fatty acids. But I guess on the plus side, even though you're saying like here's the main things to do, we're talking about patterns here, right? Over
right.
50 years, they found patterns. So although we're not going into detail on like exactly how to do this in your own life, we're talking about really thinking through your own patterns because this research highlights that.
Right, and I think one of the things this research does as well is helps us to not say, oh, we need technology to make us healthier. You know, we need
right.
the newest
a new
technology.
Tool, yeah, new
because
book,
the
yeah.
funny thing, we talked about this before, the Mediterranean diet isn't really the Mediterranean diet anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to Greece and Italy and all these places, they're not necessarily doing it the same way as what the historic Mediterranean diet
back to
was
basics.
Done. Yeah, so
that's
I mean,
what this research shows.
Yeah, going backwards and eating a diet that's more down to what our great grandparents and I think we now have to go more and more generations back to really find this diet, but it's there, you know, it's been eaten, and I think it shows that you know, eating a good balance of real good whole foods, whole vegetable foods, really can help heart health.
So that study in the news actually gets pretty specific, but I guess you have some research too to share with us that's not quite so specific in the tactics, but does sort of take like a top level look over a pretty broad spectrum. I think what, like 30,000 people?
Yeah, so what you have here is I was kind of like, you know, looking through the news and found that news article.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, well, what else is out there? What else can I find?
Yeah.
That one, you know, some of the when we talk about randomized controlled studies, those are really getting more specific and getting more down to a narrow view.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, something like this study, which is actually the research I found is a cohort study, which looks, like you're saying, much broader range.
Right.
And you can do a larger study. So this study looks at almost 30,000 people that were started out in the study, at least. And in 52 countries, every inhabitable continent was represented.
Using their
here.
Words, right?
Yeah, but that's so, right. That's what they say.
Cohort meaning kind of observing people that have issues or don't have issues.
Right. So, yeah. So, I'm sorry. This is a case control study.
The
one we were talking about before was core. I'm sorry. This is case control where you say, okay, I have one person that has the problem. Let me pick another control to go along with them and find out the
differences
between the two.
So that's a case control. Right. Okay.
So case control is just underneath the cohort in some of the ways that you can draw conclusions from it, but it allows you to do this huge type of study, this large range.
Economically, okay.
Yeah, so that's really what's great about this study is it's so large range. It's so... it's just huge from a standpoint of how you look at a number of people, a number of countries involved. We can't draw specifics from this, but we can kind of take an overview and say, okay, what seems to be a general pattern?
And the pattern they're looking for is what puts you at risk for like a first time heart attack.
Right.
So they study people who have that risk or have had that or...
So have had a heart attack. So they took people that had a first-time heart attack and compared them to a group that has not had a heart attack. And they wanted to find out, okay, can modifiable risk factors, so mm-hmm. things that we could actually change...
That you can control.
Yeah.
Okay.
How much does that play into their risk for that first-time heart attack?
Okay.
So the people that had the heart attack, the people that didn't, what's so different about you? And in those differences, how many of those are modifiable?
That's a good question.
And then what percentage can we expect that if we did modify those things that
you
have?
Now, what I'm going to think is family history is going to play a huge part in it. I mean, that's my what I would go into it thinking. But what did they find?
Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of what you kind of go into these things. And when you hear about it, I feel like increasingly I'm hearing more about people's family history, and like they're saying, well, that my family history is this, and so I can't really do much about it. But I think that's what this study really talks to, is that we find that these modifiable risk factors, which means that things I control, 9 of them, they account, what they concluded in the study was that they account for over 90% of the risk for first-time heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And so to even break that number out a little bit, regular consumption of fruit and vegetables was associated with 30% relative risk reduction. And then you add to the eating fruits and vegetables to exercise and avoiding smoking, that goes all the way up to 80% lower relative risk for a first-time heart attack from what this study is looking at. Once again, one study, but I mean, because of the size of the study, I mean, I think it really gives a lot of weight to these numbers, and we can see that, you know, some very basic things of fruits and vegetables, exercise, smoking, 80% lower risk. That's just, I mean, I don't even know. It starts to become mind-boggling in some ways.
I mean, that's a huge, huge percentage in terms of what you can influence with what's in your change. And that's different than my paradigm. I just assumed, you know, 80% of my problem was family history, and then I could affect it a little bit if I change things. But so this study, over 30,000 people, which how does it break down exactly? Is it maybe like 15,000 people were actually had the
so
first...
You have, I think 15,000 were included in the study group and 14,000 in the control group.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have some people drop out and some people are not qualified. And, you know, it's like they have to work through some of those numbers in the beginning, but that's about where
it's much
up.
Different than saying I studied 20 people or 100 people and I found these risk factors and family history didn't impact it much. Or I guess did they find that family history impacted it a lot?
Yeah,
or not?
So what we do is we throw these modifiable risk factors into the hat and say how much effect they have. Well, they found 90% of the modifiable of the risk factor was from these modifiables. Well, how much was family history on top of that then?
Mm-hmm.
If you add in family history, it only gets a 1% increase to a 91%. And so that is just obviously not a huge change. And what they're saying is not that family history doesn't play a role.
Yeah.
But its role is not as cut and dry as what we initially thought. So what your role ends up being here is that the role, the actual role of that family history plays is not necessarily just all wrapped up in genetics. Mm-hmm. It can be wrapped up in other factors, and they think that most of the other parts of family history is really wrapped up in things that you can modify.
Yeah. I mean, and something that we say all the time to customers at Oat Health is really to, you know, to give your body a fighting chance.
And right.
That's really, to me, that's what this sounds like. You know, that if you do these things, that you can give yourself a fighting chance. So that's, I think, a really interesting study to look into. Now, on both the news and research show, we'll have some of the links posted on the podcast page in the show notes.
Yeah, these are just like a little bit of an appetizer.
So you can read further.
You really got to get into it yourself. We want to just kind of make you aware of these things and want you to get into it yourself as well.
And that applies to every podcast, but we'll remind you each time and provide the show notes and the links to things you can dig into further on the external resources. But today, moving on to our main topic, is how really three theories of disease might be impacting your life in ways that you actually might not realize, or you may. But either way, this is, I think, a good topic to get into.
Yeah, and I mean, this doesn't sound like the way to start for a lot of people. Like, oh my gosh, here we go, theories and all. But you know, when you find out, when you really start to think about what influences my day-to-day decisions, mm-hmm. you know, what kind of things, and somebody else's theories may affect your way of looking at disease and your way of looking at health. And so I thought it was important to do that. These three theories came out of my sociology class at Marquette.
Oh boy,
when I was there.
Yeah,
my biomedical science degree, and just. Really some interesting stuff. I'm not realizing that. I really enjoyed that class because it looks more at, okay, what affects how we look at disease, and these three theories. Definitely, as we go through them, I think you'll see that they do play a role. And I think understanding different approaches to disease can help you determine how you approach disease.
So just to be clear, I mean, this is something that you would learn as a student you study biomedical sciences, right? But maybe pre-med and the different disciplines, you would be on some version of this track. You're going to be influenced by these theories, which means once people get into their careers and all those things, this is a part. I mean, you don't think about it every day, but this is a part of how you're trained. Right. So it is, in fact, what do you want to call it? A foundational brick,
right,
in the whole system that we don't actually think about consciously.
Right. If you don't take a class, or if you're not directly having to make decisions based on the theories, you know, then you may not like realize how much influence they have.
So it's not conscious, but it's part of it. So that's why you're bringing it up today.
Yeah. So as a medical system, we do take a look at all the different theories, and they all do play a role. But you definitely see some of them come out at the head, mm-hmm. and some of them come out as more influential than others. And I think depending on which realm you're in, so a nutritionist, let's say, will have a different view and will come at it with a little bit of a different approach maybe, or maybe like a naturopathic doctor. And you know, so you kind of cut each category, but what we find in America is medical doctors generally play the largest role in how this kind of trickles down to the individual.
Yeah. You know, everybody has their different focus.
Right.
But I guess what are the, before we get into each, the details of each one, what are the three?
The three main theories we're going to talk about are the germ theory,
which really
talks about that there's something that has come into me, or there's some specific thing that is causing disease. So the easiest to see is like cold and flu, right? I have a bacterial infection, I have a viral infection. You know, that is causing my disease.
So that's number one, germ theory.
That's number one. The next one is environmental theory. So mm-hmm. like the water that I drink, the air that I breathe, the social, economical situation I'm in.
All so the my external factors.
Right, that's around me play a role. And I think that, you know, that's pretty easy to kind of cut through and find what that looks like. And then the lifestyle theory is the last one, meaning that I have decisions to make that will influence my health. And so diet and lifestyle are some of those things.
So this is interesting because, like you said, it is part of everyday life. It's a part of training. And then even, you know, just the news and research we just read, it seems like those same theories are part of what people are studying. So this is important stuff. So I'm wondering if you could just expand a little bit on each one. So germ theory is the first one.
Yeah, and so germ theory, it's you know, basically how our medical system looks at disease. And so we try to find out what is the problem and let me solve it. And so I think it's contrasted to the, it's easiest to think about this definition contrasted to the idea of holistic approach. So if I look at your whole body, your whole situation around you,
including and emotions and all those things,
if I can look at everything instead of just saying, okay, inside your body there's a bacteria, or inside, you know, if I can look at, oh, your body has an immune system that's influenced by sunlight, that's influenced by, you know, the air you breathe, the water you drink, or, you know, the foods that you're eating, the nutrients.
But ultimately, you go into the doctor because I have a cold. I mean, he or she has to really look at what is the symptom, right?
Right.
And then what's the issue, and you try to get to the bottom of that. So that's part of germ theory.
And that, and then you design a medical system to deal with those individual issues.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't design the medical system to look at your body and say, how do we make it healthier to fight? We say, let me look at the one issue and go right after it. And, you know, we end up with very targeted drugs and some of those things that are very beneficial for some people that have very specific, especially life-threatening issues.
Right.
This theory works out, I think, great in an emergency setting. Sometimes when you're in emergency and you're having a life or death situation within the next few days, you know, so it's like you have to find a solution for this. We have come up with some medications I think that can really be beneficial for emergency cases.
Right.
So, so that's a lot of kind of where we start with the germ theory. The environmental theory, I think, we're not going to go too much into that. I think some people can get an idea of what that looks like. But if you think of, like, I'm a coal miner and I work all day in a coal mine, I'm going to be influenced by my environment. There's just no way around it. I can't be like, well, I'll take my approach from the germ theory and from the lifestyle theory. I'll just eat a good diet and I'll just, you know, take the appropriate medication when it's needed.
But you're still breathing.
I'm worried about my,
you're still breathing air that maybe isn't the best for you.
I'm worried about my job is really influencing the 99% of my health issues. So,
well, and that's an extreme case, but couldn't it also be, you know, if you were, let's say, this is still a dramatic example, but if you were an air traffic controller, I mean, you're exposed to really high levels of stress every day.
Right.
And that's another component of environment. But I guess, could you just outline again, what are the components of environmental theory that, like in a university setting, you're talking about Marquette, that they would go into?
So some of the things you look at, and this theory will take on a few different forms depending on who you talk to and how you get their spin on it. But, you know, I would say just a general kind of overview, you know, air and water pollution definitely can make a difference. Chemicals in the environment definitely can, if you don't know about them, you're just kind of, you know, exposed to them on a regular basis. Heavy metals, some of those type of things. And once again, social, economical situations that will influence what access you have to different things. So all these things have an influence that you have some role to play. You can avoid. You can be an avoidant. So, like, you know, in our most extreme example there, the coal miner, they technically could get a different job now, as trapped in a job as someone might be. But, you know, could technically could get another job. So there's some part of that that's modifiable and some parts that are not as modifiable.
But the fact is where you're located and what you do and all these things that you're exposed to externally, you know, have a factor in your overall health.
Right. And I think what now, like, looking, overviewing these three is really the fact that we just need to take a balanced view. And so from OdaHealth.com, we're going to be heavily skewed towards the lifestyle theory.
Right.
Because that's the one we look at the most
from our standpoint.
That's our role. Like, that's our spin on it. That's our, you know, so at the end of the day, it's our bias. But we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about how can I make an effect. And that's why we really highlighted the news today and the research that we did. Because we feel strongly that you can influence your health through,
so,
you know.
Are there kind of four main facets of lifestyle that you hear a lot about?
Well, yeah. So there's diet and there's exercise. And then there's, you know, avoidance, things like smoking and heavy drinking and those type of things. I think that's the three main ones you kind of look at.
Okay, so there's three main ones, you know, exercise, diet, and then what you introduce into your body, basically smoking, drinking, those types of things.
Right, and then what you're looking at here is kind of a way to say, okay, all of these play a part. All of these theories play a part in
my disease.
So
germ theory, environmental, lifestyle, they all have a factor.
Right, but this is the one we have the most control over. This is the one
day-to-day
we can make decisions based on and really improve our health. And so all of them mixed together, I don't want to like say, well, our way is better, and you know, like, neglect all the other ways. Because if you have a serious infectious disease, you can't just eat a better diet that day and hope for the best, you know.
Or like you said, the emergency situation. Yeah. I mean, my daughter just recently, you know, she broke her leg, she injured herself, and I was very thankful that we have the training in sort of germ theory and diagnosing what's exactly wrong with you and
right.
those types of things. And I'm very thankful to understand some things about my environment, right? Right. So they all factor in whether we want to accept right. it or not. But like you said, we're here for the lifestyle factor. That's right.
And I think what we need to look at is the body has a lot of mechanisms within itself. If we give it the right tools,
okay.
to actually to be able to create health for itself.
Optimizing
is a good word. I think we undercut that word because sometimes we get sent home from the doctor with a bad taste in our mouth because they couldn't give us something. We know we feel bad.
Yeah.
I don't feel right, doc. You know, what can I do? Well, you don't have anything wrong. Go home. I think sometimes we can look at some of these things that we can change in lifestyle, diet, exercise, and you know, some of the avoidance. We can look at some of these things and say, okay, what can I do about this to maybe optimize how I feel?
Right.
More energy, you know, maybe think better throughout the day. Some of these things that I'm not as energetic as I used to be. I'm not thinking as straight as I used to.
So you're saying maybe if germ theory, if that environment isn't capable of diagnosing our problem, there could be other things that we could do along the way, sort of a plan or tactic that might. It's not saying cure disease per se,
right?
But just make us feel a little better day to day,
right? Optimizing health. I think that's what we're a lot about here, and so I think to kind of just look back over that, it's really about a balance once again.
Mm-hmm.
Just like anything else, it's really about looking at a balance, and I think some of this, looking at the activity level, and once again, looking at the state of where we're at right now, and maybe even taking a look back and saying, how can we recapture some of what we used to have in that way? It's not to be too nostalgic, but I think there's just some value in that as well. So
sure. Well, I think that is all the time we have today, but I realize some of what we said today might just be whetting your appetite and you have some questions, but not to worry. You know, bear with us because in the coming weeks, we'll continue to dive deeper into each component. Try to give you just a little bit at a time so you know you can digest it, right?
Yeah.
And do you have some ideas about what's to come?
Yeah, so we want to delve in a little bit into that Western dietary pattern, some food processing. you know, food processing has upside and downside. Let's look at both. You know, let's not cut through and let's just not demonize everything, but let's look through so we can take an honest evaluation.
Right.
I think what we don't want to do is like say, oh, we all need to go raw food organic tomorrow. And it's like, that's just not happening.
Yeah.
My house doesn't
have
some
practical ways to identify trade-offs.
So yeah, so be able to look at decision A and decision B and then say, okay, I'm going to make this bad decision today because I need to, because it gives me this trade-off for today.
Okay.
And then eventually, you know, those things can be outweighed eventually. So
that's a great topic to get into, and I'm excited to do that. Please join us again. That's all the time we have today. Thanks for sharing today, Joe.
All right, thank you.
And that's our podcast for today at oathealth.com. This is again, and we'll be sure to share more. As always, look further for yourself or provide the resources on the podcast page in the show notes. Thanks again.
Thanks.